Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from this week's edition of The Week magazine, dated February 17th, 2012. And our first item this week from the main story section of The Week magazine, a surge in hiring points to a real recovery. What happened? A surprisingly strong month of hiring by private businesses sparked hopes this past week that the U.S. economic recovery was now shifting into a higher gear, sending stock prices soaring and giving a big boost to President Obama's reelection campaign. The Labor Department's jobs report for January showed that employers added a net of 243,000 jobs, the largest gain in 9 months. The unemployment rate fell to 8.3%, down from a high of 10% in 2009. Job gains for previous months were also revised up from 200,000 to 203,000 in December and from 100,000 to 157,000 in November. President Obama said the report proved his administration had turned the economy around. "I deserve a second term, but we're not done," he said. In 2009, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month. Now we're creating 250,000. All told, the economy has generated 3.7 million new jobs since the recovery began 23 months ago. But other indicators pointed to continued long-term problems in the labor market. More than 40% of the unemployed, around 5.5 million people, have been out of work for 6 months or more, and at least 8.2 million people are working part-time because they cannot find full-time jobs. Mitt Romney, the front-runner for the GOP's presidential nomination, said the current recovery was a cyclical inevitability, but that Obama's policies have slowed down the recovery and made it more difficult. Here's what the editorial said. "That's more like it," said the New York Daily News. "For the first time in years, the recovery is truly picking up momentum, and all sectors of the economy are sharing in the gains. Manufacturing hires were up 50,000 by 50,000 people. Leisure and hospitality rose by 44,000 and business services by 70,000. Of course, there's still plenty to worry about. The housing market is sick unto death and the deficit is soaring. So it's an uphill climb, but at least we're headed in the right direction." "Hold the celebration," said the Wall Street Journal. "This is still by far the worst jobs recovery since the Great Depression. The U.S. still has 5.5 million fewer jobs than when the recession began in December 2007, and yet Obama thinks the answer to the nation's problems is to raise taxes on job creators," said the New York Post. "Such foolishness will only add to the 47 million Americans now on food stamps, an all-time high." Now here's what the columnist said. "Do you hear the champagne corks popping in the West Wing?" said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. "If the economy adds between 180,000 and 250,000 jobs every month between now and the election, the jobless rate will fall below 8%, about where it stood when Obama took office. At that point, Romney's entire case for election crumbles. Still, Romney has no choice but to run on economic pessimism," said Jonathan Chait in NewYorkMag.com. "Obama's foreign policy has been very successful, and polls show that Obama is personally popular, while Romney and the Republican Party are very unpopular. If the economy keeps improving, the election is Obama's to lose." History suggests otherwise, said Janet Hook in the Wall Street Journal. Since 1960, four presidents have run for re-election with a jobless rate higher than 7%. Only Ronald Reagan won, and that's because in 1984 the economy was growing at a super-fast rate of more than 8%, while unemployment fell steeply. Today it's growing at an anemic 3%, and unemployment is likely to remain above 8% in November. That would put the president firmly in the danger zone. And a continued recovery is not at all guaranteed, said Derek Thompson in TheAtlantic.com. If Europe falls apart or war breaks out with Iran, sending oil prices skyrocketing, the negative impact could be severe. Another partisan battle over extending the payroll tax for the rest of 2012, a distinct possibility, could also shake consumer confidence. Still, if the electeds in Washington avoid drawing too much attention to themselves, this recovery could be a keeper. The next item from the main story section is entitled Santorum's Surge. Rick Santorum revived his campaign for the Republican presidential nomination this past week with a trio of surprise victories in the Minnesota and Colorado caucuses and in Missouri's non-binding primary. In yet another twist in the saga of the GOP race, the former Pennsylvania senator won all three states by healthy margins, strengthening his argument that he, and not Newt Gingrich, is the real conservative alternative to frontrunner Mitt Romney. Santorum's unexpected rise also cast doubt on Romney's ability to run away with the race. Repeated Romney gaffes have raised new questions about his electability, while sluggish voter turnout in the primaries that he won, down 14% from 2008 in Florida and 26% in Nevada, suggests that conservative voters still lack enthusiasm for the former Massachusetts governor. This week marked a new chapter in the GOP race, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Gingrich's baggage has finally pushed him down to the bottom of the pack, and his campaign is now on the ropes. Santorum, on the other hand, will now almost certainly emerge as the final anti-Romney contender. His positive conservative message appealed to both pro-lifers and blue-collar workers in the Midwest. Romney will have to compete hard to win in Michigan at the end of February. Santorum still has work to do, said Jay Cost in NationalReview.com. Gingrich is not about to sail quietly into the night, despite his poor showing in this week's contest. Santorum's next task is to convince conservatives to coalesce behind him and not the former speaker, and to use all the free media he can get to overcome both Gingrich's bombast and Romney's money advantage. Money is about the only advantage Romney has left, said Nate Silver in the New York Times. He lost Minnesota and Colorado, despite having easily won both in 2008, about the worst results conceivable for the man who was once considered the inevitable nominee. Romney's deep unpopularity with highly conservative Republican voters and the tumbling turnout figures are not the hallmarks of a race with a dominant candidate. Now that Santorum has won four out of the eight nominating contests, Romney has a much longer and more difficult race ahead than he or anyone else thought. The next item is entitled Israel Hints at War with Iran. President Obama began enforcing tough new economic sanctions against Iran this past week as Israeli leaders publicly discussed a military strike against Iranian nuclear facilities. The U.S. froze the assets of Iran's government and financial institutions in the U.S., warning other nations that there will be penalties for doing business with the rogue nation. By isolating Iran's central bank, the U.S. and Europe hope to choke off the country's oil revenue and escalate the pressure on the Islamic Republic to abandon its bid for a nuclear bomb. Iran dismissed the sanctions as propaganda, insisting that the country's nuclear energy program would move forward. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said the time for diplomacy is past, noting that Iran is building nuclear weapons labs and bomb-proof bunkers deep underground. He who says later, Barak said, may find that it is too late. The saber-rattling on both sides is getting frightening, said the New York Times in an editorial. Rumors of an Israeli attack this spring are spreading in world capitals. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu supposedly has decided that Obama won't dare to stop him in the middle of an election campaign. An Israeli attack would trigger a bloody and potentially disastrous regional war that would drag in the United States, whether we like it or not. Tough sanctions and a united diplomatic front are the best chance for crippling Iran's nuclear program. Israel is entirely justified in viewing a nuclear Iran as an existential threat, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei last week called Israel a tumor on this region that must be cut off. And this belligerent messianic regime has repeatedly indicated that it will never let Israel live in peace. But the decision to go to war cannot be Israel's alone, said Leslie Gelb in the DailyBeast.com. If attacked, Tehran would unleash a wave of terrorists, possibly armed with chemical and biological weapons, to strike at American targets here and abroad. Gas would soar to $15 a gallon. While the sanctions do their work, we urgently need a comprehensive U.S. and Israeli proposal that gives Tehran room to compromise. Otherwise, we're stuck on today's collision course with Iran. Now we'll look at the controversy of the week from the main story section of the Week magazine. It's entitled, Romney, Too Gaffe-Prone to Beat Obama. What is wrong with this guy, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Every time Mitt Romney is on the verge of sewing up the Republican presidential nomination, he says something so painfully dumb that you have to wonder if he might simply be not a good enough politician to beat President Obama in November. Given his $250 million in wealth and country club demeanor, Romney can't afford to say things like, I like being able to fire people, or that the $374,000 he earned from speaking fees last year was not very much. Romney's biggest gaffe to date, though, came last week when he told CNN, I'm not concerned about the very poor since they have a safety net. In his tone-deaf way, Romney was trying to say he'd focus on the beleaguered middle class if elected president. But for conservatives trying to convince themselves that Romney is their best choice, this latest verbal blunder was very worrisome. Every political misspeaks from time to time, said David Paul Kuhn in RealClearPolitics.com, but Romney's gaffes are no joke. Every item on his now extensive blooper reel, including his casual offer to bet Rick Perry $10,000, feeds into the caricature of a rich man who is out of touch. In the general election, Obama will attempt to make wealth, taxes, and income inequality the central issues, and Romney is framing himself as a near-perfect Democratic foil. Look, Romney will never be a smooth, folksy politician, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But what independent voters must ultimately decide is whether they want a clueless, bogus populist like Obama charting out our future course over a smart technocrat who knows how the economy works. Over his long, highly successful career in the private sector, Romney showed a real talent for analyzing and solving problems. And behind his stiff and awkward exterior, there's clearly a very decent, charitable, and intelligent man. Ultimately, come election time, Romney's verbal weaknesses will be offset by the public's good opinion of his strengths. Good luck with that, said Jacob Weisberg in Slate.com. In presidential politics, personality matters a lot. Just ask Al Gore and John Kerry. Like them, Romney is now running away from his wealth and privileged perfection by affecting a plain folk's ordinariness that only marks him as inauthentic. It didn't help when the guy who pays 14% taxes on his multimillion-dollar income told a crowd of jobless Floridians, I'm unemployed too, or pandered to the gun lobby with his claim to have gone hunting more than two times. Romney's in a real bind, said Paul Fahrey in the Washington Post. Critics complain he's robotic, yet when he goes off script, he says things that make his supporters cringe. Don't write him off yet, said Michael Gerson, also in the Washington Post. Romney has shown over two presidential campaigns that he learns from his mistakes. And don't forget that Obama, too, has made foolish comments, such as rural voters clinging to God and guns. It will be the state of the economy next November that decides this election. Maybe so, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com, but Romney has a problem that goes beyond his gaffes. To win over conservatives, he's promised a whopping tax cut for wealthy one percenters like him, while paying for it by cutting programs for people who aren't like him, and that is virtually everyone else. Romney could have a tongue made of pure silver and ooze empathy from every pore, but at a time when people are hurting, that will still be a very, very tough sell. And now from the main story section of the Week magazine, we will turn to a very popular column entitled A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for knowing your place. After Roy and Dorothy Fleming of Brookfield, Wisconsin celebrated their 80th wedding anniversary. He knows who's boss. That's how we got along, said Dorothy, who is 95. Whatever she says is right, agreed Roy, who is 100 years old. And it was a good week for David Cho, a graffiti artist who in 2005 chose to take Facebook shares rather than his usual fee for painting murals at Facebook's former headquarters in Palo Alto, California. Now that Facebook is going public, those shares may soon be worth $200 million. And it was a good week for Bradying, a new internet craze that is a variation on T-bowing. People who Brady sit with legs stretched out, head down, just like New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady's dejected on-field posture after his team lost the Super Bowl. And it was a bad week for family traditions after a Pennsylvania man drove to a police station to pick up a son just charged with drunk driving. Police determined that the father was drunk and charged him with DUI. It was a bad week for Miami after it was rated the most miserable city in the U.S. by Forbes magazine, beating poverty-stricken Detroit. The magazine cited Miami's crippling foreclosure crisis, unemployment problem, high crime rate, taxes, and choked commuter roads. And it was a bad week for living your dreams after John C. Hughes of Butte, Montana, led police on a wild 100-mile-per-hour chase that ended only when police blew out his tires. When asked why he baited cops into chasing him, Hughes, who was sober and had committed no crime, responded, "I just always wanted to do that." And from the Week magazine this week, we will now turn to the People section. Our first item is entitled, Radcliffe Grows Up. Daniel Radcliffe isn't Harry Potter anymore, said Sally Williams in the London Telegraph. The actor, who is 22 years old, spent most of last year starring in a Broadway production of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. The role required Radcliffe to dance and do handstands, knee slides, and even a kick-up, springing upright from a lying position. He couldn't dance a step when he joined the cast. Moreover, Radcliffe Radcliffe is so lacking in coordination that he struggles to tie his shoelaces. These, he says, pinging his laces, are elastic. So how did he master the routines? Well, once you put the hours in, it's just about learning and learning and repetition until you pick it up. Radcliffe is no stranger to hard work. Cast as Harry Potter at age 11, he spent much of the next 10 years on a film lot in southern England. A car would collect him from his home in London at 7:30 a.m. and drop him back again at 8:30 p.m. Radcliffe admits that he wasn't much of an actor in the beginning and that he spent the first two films just reading the lines. But while making the third, he became determined to learn how to act. When you get as lucky as I got, you have to work as hard as possible to earn that luck. The next item from the People's section is Life as a Super Tutor. Topaz Calland tutors the offspring of the rich and the famous, said Barbara McMahon in the London Times. And I should point out that that Topaz is T-O-P-E-S. And Calland is C-A-L-L-A-N-D. I'm not 100% sure of the pronunciation of Topaz, but we'll go with that for now. The Oxford University graduate is paid vast sums to teach kids with super successful parents how to get good grades and get along with their peers. Now, most of them simply need a bit of one-on-one help. Then there are the ones he calls the too cool for school celebrateens who have serious behavioral problems. The children of incredibly successful parents can be crushed by the feeling that they're never going to be as successful, he says. Often they're living in an environment that can intensify feelings of inadequacy, or they're put in an expensive school they're not suited for. Rich parents often react by throwing money at the problem. Recently, Calland was working with a 12-year-old girl who has been reading the diary of Anne Frank. The mum canceled lessons for the next day, and we flew to Amsterdam on the family jet to see the Frank Museum, he recalls. I'm not sure it was quite as moving an experience as it might have been. There's a shop at the end of the tour with the diary translated into scores of languages. The girl's response was, "This is crap. The gift store's just full of books." And the next item is Paltrow's healthy obsession. Gwyneth Paltrow is obsessed with her health, said Justine Picardi in Harper's Bazaar. Every weekday morning, she spends an hour and a half with her personal trainer doing dance aerobics and a precise set of exercises that changes every 10 days. The idea, says Paltrow, 39, is that you're muscular, but don't get used to anything. Right now, she's also on a 12-week detox program. I have a lot of inflammation in my system, so I'm not having anything I'm allergic to. No gluten, no dairy, no sugar. She embraced a clean living lifestyle in 2002 after her beloved father, hard-drinking, chain-smoking director Bruce Paltrow, died of throat cancer at age 58. All I've learned about health came from his cancer. I'll probably have a long and healthy life because he didn't. When Paltrow talks about her father, her eyes fill with tears, and she touches his wedding ring, which hangs on a gold chain around her neck. I would do anything to have him back, but half the reason my life is good, has real value, is that he died, she says. As much pain and heartache as his death has caused, there was an equal amount of positivity. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for the week of February 17th, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the briefing section, this one entitled China's Growing Pains. China is finding that its economic prosperity comes with a price: inequality, social division, and political unrest. What's wrong with China? It's struggling to cope with the consequences of its own rapid economic growth. China's economy grew at a red-hot rate of 10% a year for the last decade, making the country as a whole much more affluent. But the growth has been very unevenly spread over the vast population of 1.3 billion, causing bitterness and discord. The economic boom has created a new and very visible wealthy class of top government officials and private business owners, including more than 500,000 millionaires who travel abroad, drive Mercedes-Benzes and Rolls-Royces, and adorn their wrists with Rolex watches. But on average, the Chinese are only about as wealthy as Jamaicans or Albanians. As a result, China is now suffering from serious social, economic, and political problems that have left its population restless and its leadership worried. Will the economic growth continue? It's already slowing, dipping below 9% in one quarter last year. That partly reflects the Chinese economy's heavy reliance on exports, which have dropped off since recession-stung Europeans and Americans pull back on purchases of consumer goods. China's rising wages, ironically, are also a factor. Some industries, particularly clothing and footwear, are moving factories from China to Indonesia and Bangladesh, where they can still pay workers pennies a day. But the biggest threats to China's economy are inflation and a housing bubble. The newly rich pour their earnings into real estate, driving prices way up. Many also invested in the private underground lending industry, which thrives because official Chinese banks often refuse to make private loans. In at least one city, Wenzhou, a wave of defaults of these underground bank loans has set off a rash of suicides among people who can't pay their debts. How widespread is the anger? It reaches deep into Chinese society. The rural poor are complaining that wages and incomes are rising in cities, but not among those who live in the countryside. Some are beginning to rise up in protest against rampant corruption among local officials who seize land from peasants and farmers and sell it at a great profit to developers. In a case that generated international attention, townspeople in the southern fishing village of Wuhan banded together in December and drove out the local communist authorities. They have been allowed to elect a new government. Tens of millions of rural residents have simply abandoned the countryside to try to find better-paying jobs in the cities. In a single generation, the urban share of China's population has doubled from 25% in 1990 to more than 50% today. That massive migration has put unimaginable stress on the cities. Do the migrants fit in? They're not really allowed to. The centuries-old system of hukou requires all Chinese citizens to register in their birth villages, and when they move, the new jurisdiction often refuses to grant them residency. At least 200 million people who have moved to the cities for work lack access to vital social services, including health care and schools, and many live in shantytowns on the city's edges. A toddler who was run over last year and left to bleed in the street, an event captured on video and replayed endlessly on the internet to the horror of the Chinese public, was from one such disenfranchised family. Despite some recent reforms, the hukou system is still contributing to a marginalization of migrants that The Economist has called China's apartheid system. What about factory workers? Well, they too are getting restless. Strikes for higher wages and better working conditions are becoming more frequent, and the explosive popularity of Weibo, the Chinese version of Twitter, has allowed news of local unrest to spread around the country. Last November, employees at a shoe factory rioted over layoffs and salary cuts, and images of their bloody clashes with police went viral on the internet. A report by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences found that strikes have become more confrontational and more likely to inspire copycat actions. How are authorities reacting? With a combination of repression and reform. In an attempt to prevent local protests and uprisings from turning into a destabilizing contagion, Beijing authorities in December ordered that all Weibo users must use their real names. Individuals who complain too vigorously about corruption, wages, or industrial pollution are sometimes dragged off to jails or mental institutions. But in a conciliatory gesture, Premier Wen Jiabao recently called for better protection of farmers' land rights. And one vocal advocate of such reform, Guangdong Provincial Party leader Wang Yang, is expected to be appointed to the Politburo Standing Committee later this year, when all but two of its nine members will be replaced. The Communist Party is mindful of the need to carefully calibrate its response to growing public dissension. The last time such a large turnover in the party's top leadership coincided with an economic downturn was 1988. A year later, simmering frustration with the government erupted into the protests in Tiananmen Square. And the footnote to this article, the end of the one-child policy. China's policy of allowing only one child per family, introduced in 1978, has become a demographic time bomb. In the next 30 years, as a wave of older people retire, China will go from having eight workers per retiree to just two. An enormous and unsustainable change for the economy. What's more, the policy has implicitly encouraged selective abortions of girls, since the Chinese still value a single son more than a daughter. The result is a glut of boys. There are 32 million more of them under 20 today than females. Such a large mass of men who can't marry and have poor job prospects, sociologists say, is a recipe for social upheaval. Many analysts believe that authorities will soon revoke the one-child policy. Propaganda posters have already been spotted showing families with two children. But the change may come too late. China is already past the tipping point. Deutsche Bank global strategist Sanjeev Sanyal says, because of a combination of gender imbalance and a very skewed age structure. Now we'll take a look at the best columns in the U.S. as determined by The Week magazine for this past week. The first article is entitled A Modest Proposal for Bribing Voters by Stephen Perelstein in The Washington Post. Who says government can't get anything right, asked Stephen Perelstein. Just 2 years ago in the landmark Citizens United case, the Supreme Court finally liberated casino magnates, hedge fund managers, and other powerless billionaires to exercise their constitutional right to free speech and pour hundreds of millions of dollars into super PAC attack ads. If the court's conservative majority had not lifted those limits, just think of how many voices, how many opinions, how many great ideas would have never reached the voters in the Republican presidential primary. But why stop there? As a logical next step, the court should allow citizens to sell their votes to the highest bidder. Bribing voters is an honored tradition in this country, and it's not banned by the Constitution. For an investment of a mere $10 billion, wealthy corporations and individuals could simply pay people to vote for a designated candidate in key swing states, saving oppressed job creators everywhere from the horrors of democracy and regulation by the rabble. Super PACs are just the start. By legalizing bribery, we can finally bring the magic of the free market to the electoral process. The next column is entitled, What Clint Didn't Say About Detroit, by Rich Lowry in the New York Post. With his gravelly-voiced credibility, Clint Eastwood delivered the most memorable and controversial Super Bowl ad this year, said Rich Lowry. But the two-minute ad touting Chrysler's comeback after a government bailout was based on half-truths and political propaganda. In the ad, Eastwood growls that Detroit is recovering because we all pull together. Who is we? Congress never approved the $80 billion in taxpayer money that both the Bush and Obama administrations poured into Chrysler and GM, $23 billion of which we'll probably never get back. The government takeovers of the companies were accomplished by legally dubious executive high-handedness, not patriotic collective action. In glorifying the bailout, Eastwood didn't mention that Chrysler and GM were saved only because they are also declared bankruptcy so they could pare down exorbitant wages and benefits, close unprofitable dealerships, and kill dated brands. The government also sold off 58.5% of Chrysler's stock to Fiat. Eastwood's "we" presumably must include Italy. It's good that Chrysler and GM are now off life support, but if the Detroit bailout is the model for America's future, we should prepare for national collapse. And the next item is entitled "The Joys of Living Alone" by Eric Klinenberg in the New York Times. "More people live alone than at any other time in history," said Eric Klinenberg. "In major U.S. cities such as Atlanta, Denver, and Minneapolis, 40% of households contain a single occupant. In Manhattan and Washington, D.C., nearly 50% of households consist of one person. Throughout the country, 32 million people live alone, 15 million of them between the ages of 34 and 65. Once most people thought about living alone with a sense of anxiety, dread, and feelings of loneliness. But today, many appreciate the freedom and independence from intrusive family members, annoying roommates, or spouses that turn out to be the wrong person. Far from being lonely, research shows single people are generally more socially active than those who hunker down at home and are more likely to spend time with friends and neighbors. And the advent of online social networking makes the solitary existence less isolated still, allowing us to engage with others when and how we want to and on our own terms. It may not be for everyone, but going solo has clearly become a viable option." And now I will flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week, and we'll turn to the section entitled "The Last Word." And the specific title of this particular week's edition is "The New Dr. Death." "With Jack Kevorkian gone," says Manuel Roig Franzia, "Lawrence Egbert is the new face of assisted suicide." Lawrence Egbert comes to his cramped third-story office almost every weekday, taking calls on an old white push-button phone with a handset darkened by years of smudged newsprint and perspiration. Egbert, a slightly built, genial, and energetic retired anesthesiologist, turns to his computer, content to answer an email while I sort through a pile of plastic tubing in a lumpy white garbage bag. Once I finish untangling the tubes, I hold in my hands a curious plastic sack, about 21 inches long and 18 inches wide. Egbert calls it an exit hood. It's a contraption that can end a life in minutes. The 84-year-old doctor, who formerly served as a campus Unitarian Universalist minister and has taught as an assistant visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University, explains how it works. "A tube connects the hood to two helium tanks," he says. "Tanks," he says. He lifts the hood over his head and lowers the open end, letting go as an elastic garter clamps to his forehead. Then, he says, you release the valves on the tanks, streaming helium into the hood. "You fill it up until it feels like a New York chef's hat," he says, stretching the hood to demonstrate. Then, he says, you pull it down and cinch it tight at the neck with a sweatband. In those final seconds before his patients lose consciousness and die, the words they utter sound like Donald Duck, he says, imitating the high-pitched, nasally squeak familiar to any child who has sucked a gulp of a helium balloon. Egbert estimates that he has been present for 100 suicides in the past 15 years, a figure that puts him in the same league with Jack Kevorkian, who claimed to have helped more than 130 people die. Egbert says he approved applications for about 300 suicides, most as medical director of the Final Exit Network, a loosely knit group that claims 3,000 dues-paying members. Even within his own organization, Egbert is controversial. The vast majority of the network's members suffer from painful physical ailments, such as late-stage cancer, he says. But unlike the group's current leadership, Egbert is also willing, in extreme cases, he says, to serve as an exit guide for patients who have suffered from depression for extended periods of time. With Kevorkian gone, he died in June. Two indictments of Egbert have transformed him into the public face of American-assisted suicide. It has been more than 17 years since Oregon voters passed a ballot initiative approving the nation's first assisted suicide law for terminally ill patients. Only one other state, Washington, has legalized the procedure, and the American Medical Association remains firmly opposed to it. Facing a trial that could further shape national opinion about assisted suicide, Egbert lacks Kevorkian's public relations flair. He's not one to dress in costumes, and he lacks Kevorkian's certitude. I expected to find an absolutist, a proselytizer for a cause. Instead, I encounter a man whose zeal is tempered by self-doubt. Once I am a true believer, that's the time I should quit, he says. I never get used to it. I'm not used to it now. Egbert has worked with patients who used barbiturates or morphine to speed their deaths, but he says those treatments can be hard to acquire in the quantities necessary to end life. Helium, on the other hand, is easy to get. Final Exit's patients are instructed that they can buy helium tanks at party stores, Egbert tells me. Remnants of his clients' visits to party stores lie at the bottom of Egbert's garbage bag, a pack of balloons, pink, blue, yellow, and green. He says patients lose consciousness within 30 to 60 seconds of pulling the hoods over their faces and are usually dead within 5 to 10 minutes. They turn blue, or bluish, we can say gray, Egbert says. After they're unconscious, their muscle starts twitching. That's very upsetting to relatives. Some think they're trying to wrench the bag off. On February 29th, 3rd, February 25th, 2009, law enforcement agents climbed the stairs of Egbert's Baltimore office and placed him under arrest as part of a probe by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation into the death of a 58-year-old man from Cumming, Georgia, named John Kelmer. The officers seized Egbert's computer and took files from a cabinet, he says. Curiously, the garbage bag full of exit hoods was left untouched. The arrest paralyzed the Final Exit Network. Exit guides, fearful of prosecution, began canceling suicides. 3 months later, Egbert, who was free on bond, was indicted, along with three others, in an Arizona case, this one involving the 2007 suicide of a 58-year-old woman from Phoenix named Jana Van Voorhis. Her sister did not know about her plans and had complained to authorities. Egbert was not present for either the suicide in Georgia or the one in Arizona, but he was the common thread in the cases. Indeed, he was the common thread in the entire Final Exit Network, as he was responsible for signing off on all suicides for the group. The Georgia case, which centers on Kelmer's death in June 2008, is moving slowly. Kelmer had discovered a lesion in his mouth in 2006 that was eventually diagnosed as cancer. His wife, Sue Kelmer, said in an interview, "The Kelmers had lived separately for 10 years, but they occupied townhouses in the same development, and he remained on her health insurance policy," she said. Chemotherapy swelled John's face, and his skin was forever hot, she said. His gum tissue deteriorated, exposing sharp bones that sliced his tongue. A hole the size of a quarter formed under his chin. In late May 2008, doctors rebuilt his jaw with bone from his calf. They shaved skin grafts from his chest and thigh, exposing raw, irritated flesh, she said. He was a mess, she said. He was furious. Unbeknownst to his wife, John had already contacted the Final Exit Network by the time he underwent the surgery. Sue believes her husband didn't tell her what he was considering because he knew she would disapprove on religious grounds. According to legal documents, he had bought an exit hood from a small company in California called GLAD, which stands for Good Life and Dignified Death. He had also bought helium tanks at a party store in Cummings. At various times, Sue said he was taking Chantix to try to quit smoking and taking oxycodone or applying morphine patches to manage his constant pain. Anybody who takes that many drugs is in no position to make decisions about their lives, she said. He was like a drowning man, and they saw it as a grand opportunity to promote their agenda and drown him. On June 19, 2008, Sue found him lying in bed, dead. The scene seemed staged, she thought. She sifted through her husband's things and found literature from the Final Exit Network. She prayed, and then she called a coroner. A post-mortem examination showed that John was cancer-free at the time of his death, according to authorities. The GBI took up the case and arranged a sting operation, contacting the Final Exit Network. During a meeting with two of the group's volunteers, Nicholas Sheridan and Claire Blair, they allegedly showed the agent how they would hold down his hands so that he couldn't remove the hood, according to the GBI. The allegation, which the volunteers have denied, contradicts the Final Network's claim that its volunteers do not actually assist in suicides, but merely provide information, guidance, and companionship. Shortly after the sting, Egbert, Sheridan, Blair, and Ted Goodwin, the group's president at the time, were all arrested on charges of assisting in a suicide, tampering with evidence, and racketeering. Since then, Sue Kelmer suspects the Final Exit Network has been playing a delay game, and she wonders why the prosecutors don't push ahead. She has already arrived at her verdict. I call it murder, she said. Hitler thought he was justified in killing people he didn't think should live. This is not a far stretch from that. While waiting for the case to play out, Egbert has agreed not to attend suicides. He wouldn't talk about the cases except to say one thing. As far as I'm concerned, I'd do it again. Even without him, the Final Exit Network is guiding people to their deaths again. Egbert is no longer the group's medical director. He hopes to resume working as an exit guide after the Georgia case. Volunteers say he'll find a changed organization, one that is more restrictive and less daring, or, depending on one's perspective, less reckless. After the Arizona case, we began to stress family notification even more than we had been, says Wendell Stevenson, a Fresno City College philosopher instructor who recently became Final Exit Network's president. Egbert has estimated that he approved 95% of applications. His presumption is that they're going to be a good candidate. Robert Rivas, the network's attorney, says of Egbert, "I don't think we have that presumption anymore." The organization, by being tighter, is saying very clearly that they'd like to reduce the likelihood of this happening again, legal stuff happening again, Egbert says. I ask him if he considers the changes a direct criticism of him. Definitely, he responds, I was annoyed. On a wet September night in 2009, the tires of Egbert's bicycle skidded through a patch of soggy leaves, and he was thrown to the roadway. He had been on his way to deliver a sermon at Johns Hopkins. The accident cracked the front and back of his pelvis. Surgery wouldn't help, the doctors told him. He would have to learn to walk with a broken pelvis. Every time he shifted his weight or tried to take a step, pain shot through his body. In his agony, Egbert, who has witnessed the endings of so many lives, considered ending his own. There are some people who like to suffer, that there is a religious gain in suffering, he says. I don't believe that. But he began to mend, and thoughts of living pushed aside thoughts of dying. When the end does come, Egbert figures, he'll go into the ground and rot. He doesn't believe in an afterlife, though many of his patients have found comfort in the belief that they will be going to a better place. I don't think it's worthwhile to worry about what happens to you when you're dead. He has been explicit about his wishes for his own death. He doesn't want to die in a nursing home or on a ventilator. When he's gone, he wants his body taken to Johns Hopkins University. He'd like it to be given to the researchers in the Parkinson's laboratory. They can place his body next to the bodies of people who died from Parkinson's disease, he reasons. He wants his body to be the scientific control. He hopes his body can be an example of a human being who died a natural death, a death without extended suffering, a death without a hood. The article was copyrighted in 2012 by the Washington Post and reprinted in The Week magazine with permission. Now from The Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the Talking Points section. Our first article here is entitled, Facebook Betting $100 Billion on Human Nature. My, how far Facebook has come, said Michael Wolff in the London Guardian, a company that founder Mark Zuckerberg started in his dorm room just 8 short years ago, has transformed business, culture, and even interpersonal relations on a world historical scale. And now comes the payoff. Facebook is about to go public, announcing an initial public offering of stock last week that valued the company at an eye-popping $100 billion. When the stock sale is held, the company will have enough cash to buy whatever it needs and extend its reach into our lives even further. Soon, 1 billion users could be logging on to Facebook to watch movies, hear music, play games, make phone calls, buy new shoes, or do virtually anything inside its private universe. It's you, the Facebook users, who provide the company with its value, said Soumani Sengupta in the New York Times, not its relatively tiny staff of 3,000 people. Facebook's content consists mostly of the vast trove of personal data that its users freely share about themselves and their desires. Every time users share a link, click a like button, visit a website, or change their relationship status, it becomes part of Facebook's file on them, which enables businesses to target individuals with specific advertising. But is this data really as valuable as the business world thinks? Will users keep surrendering it indefinitely? No one knows. Don't believe the hype, said David Weidner in the Wall Street Journal. Facebook already claims 845 million users from whom it extracts only $1 billion in profit every year. There simply aren't enough people on the planet for that user base to grow significantly in the coming years, particularly since Facebook is banned in China. So how does a $1 billion business that traffics mainly in time-wasting diversions justify a valuation of $100 billion? There's also the issue of Zuckerberg himself, says Charles Rotblood in Forbes.com, and his lack of experience in the business world. The quirky, reticent 27-year-old has retained an unheard-of level of control over Facebook and may soon find out that running a privately held startup is very different from managing a closely watched public company that has to report results. Facebook's spectacular world-changing success is hardly hype, said Larry Magid in the San Jose Mercury News. Just ask former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak or any of the Arab autocrats topple from power by citizens sharing ideas and organizing themselves over Facebook, Twitter, and the other social media. The Internet has become a potent socio-political force in its own right, said Sam Gustin in Time.com, and social networks like Facebook and Twitter are the glue that holds this force together. The next item is e-books open to government control. Might that Amazon Kindle in your hand be a threat to your freedom? Said Husna Haque in CSMonitor.com. That's what Jonathan Franzen, the acclaimed author of The Corrections and Freedom, suggested at a book festival last week. Sounding a battle cry against e-readers, the best-selling novelist railed against digital books, saying they're not for serious readers, and that their impermanence might even open the door to Orwellian censorship. If books are on e-readers and not on paper, he said, their texts can be changed or deleted by some central authority, a situation not compatible with responsible self-government. It may sound paranoid, said E.D. Kane in Forbes.com, but Franzen has a point. To ban or burn books, authoritarian governments have to hunt down every copy. But a digital text originating from some external source simply has to be turned off. Without ink or paper, it's that much easier to make Ray Bradbury's nightmare a reality. What a load of pseudo-intellectual piffle, said Andrew Sullivan in thedailybeast.com. What's more permanent than open-source digital text shared between millions of readers? Hanging out in some iCloud somewhere, the e-book will be eternal, while dead tree books will go out of print, then rot and decay. As for the threat to democracy, said Tom Chivers in telegraph.co.uk, what does Franzen think, that governments will weave political messages subtly into the text of Jane Eyre? Clearly, Franzen prefers paperbacks to e-books, but can't come out and admit to being a Luddite crank. So he's disguised his retrograde hissy fit as a grave socio-political warning. Franzen may be old-fashioned, said Ben Boychuk in Newsday.com, but his worries aren't totally misplaced. E-book sellers can exert surprising control over digital content. A few years back, Kindle owners who had bought Animal Farm discovered it had vanished when Amazon ran into a copyright problem and yanked the book back. Who's to say whether some other extraordinary circumstance might cause other e-books to mysteriously disappear? It wouldn't be that extraordinary, said Tom Sutcliffe in the London Independent. Take a look at the small print next time you buy an e-book. It's licensed, not sold to you, meaning it can't be lent, resold, or passed on to an heir when you die. For convenience, an e-reader is great, but if you want to own a book, you better buy the Dead Tree edition. And we're reaching the end of our program for this week. Here are a few short items from the Talking Point section of the Week magazine. The first one, Queen Elizabeth II, who celebrates 60 years as Great Britain's monarch this past week, has occupied the throne longer than anyone over the past 1,000 years except Queen Victoria. Vigilantism is taking hold in Detroit. Budget woes have led the city's police force to be cut by 40% over a decade to 3,000 cops, delaying police response times. At least 34 citizens killed attackers last year in what the city classified as justifiable use of force. I don't intend to be one of their victims, said Julia Brown, 73, who now has a licensed handgun. The poll watch for this week, 71% of Egyptians no longer want $1.5 billion in annual U.S. economic and military aid to their country because they believe the money influences their government's policies. And 46% of Mormons say there is a lot of discrimination against members of their religion in the U.S. today. And 68% believe other Americans do not see Mormonism as part of mainstream society. Even so, 56% believe the American public is ready to elect a Mormon as president. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.